In this module, we will look at further aspects of the taxation of rental income, starting by looking at what we call furnished holiday lettings.
We need to identify any income or losses made in respect of furnished holiday lettings.
This is because landlords with a furnished holiday let can benefit from certain tax advantages. However, this beneficial treatment was not available if the property in question was situated outside the UK.
This treatment may not have been compliant with European law, and therefore the rules in respect of furnished holiday lets will be reviewed and amended from the 6th of April 2011. A property will be treated as a furnished holiday let if five conditions are satisfied.
Firstly, and most obviously, the property needs to be furnished. The property must be situated in the UK. However, in the 2009 budget, HMRC stated that they will regard this condition as having been met if the property is located anywhere in the European Economic Area. The property must be available for commercial letting to the public for at least 140 days in the relevant period, which is usually 12 months. And out of those 140 days, the property must actually be let for 70 days or more. Accommodation is not normally regarded as holiday accommodation where it is let for a period of longer term occupation, i.e. a continuous period of more than 31 days during which the property is in the same occupation. Therefore, properties normally let on a long-term basis do not qualify as furnished holiday lets. Any such periods of longer-term occupation must, in any event, not exceed 155 days in the tax year.
Some longer-term lettings can still qualify where circumstances give rise to longer-term occupation and are not normal. The word normal ensures that genuine cases are not denied furnished holiday letting relief due to exceptional and unforeseen circumstances. This will cover examples such as where a holidaymaker falls ill or has an accident and cannot vacate the accommodation on time, or where holiday visitors unexpectedly require a longer vacation. Qualifying lettings exceeding 31 days should be the exception rather than the rule, so HMRC will review such claims critically. All of these conditions must be satisfied, and you will find these conditions listed in sections 322 to 328 of ITOIA 2005. The reason why we need to define a furnished holiday let is that landlords with FHLs can benefit from certain tax advantages, which we shall now explore. The first advantage of a furnished holiday let is that the landlord may treat any profits from that letting as earned income. This is important if the landlord wishes to make pension contributions, because the amount a taxpayer can pay into his or her pension depends on the level of their earnings. Profits on normal letting activities are not regarded as earnings for pension purposes. We shall look at pensions in a later module. The most important advantage of having a furnished holiday let comes when the letting gives rise to a loss. Under normal principles, you will recall that UK property business losses are carried forward against future UK property income. If a taxpayer makes a loss on a furnished holiday let, if he so wishes, he can still carry this loss forward against future rental profits. However, with FHLs, there is a more attractive alternative. Any losses on furnished holiday lets can be set against any income, not necessarily rental income, in the same or the previous tax year. This is the only time a rental loss can be set against non-rental income. So, for example, if a taxpayer lets out a holiday cottage and makes a loss of, say, £1,000, that loss can be set against his employment income, or his bank interest, or his dividend income for the year, to either reduce his tax liability, or perhaps generate a tax repayment. This is not permitted with normal UK property business losses. As you will see later, the legislation treats a loss on furnished holiday lets in the same way as a trading loss is treated. This will become clearer when you look at the taxation of business income. Finally, Furnished holiday lettings qualify for certain capital gains tax reliefs that normal lettings do not. These reliefs will include rollover relief, gift relief, and entrepreneur's relief, which again will mean more to you when you have studied the CGT part of your course. Moving on to overseas rental income. If a taxpayer lets out a villa in Spain, any profits are charged as income from an overseas property business. To calculate the profits on the foreign property, we use the same rules as for a UK property business, i.e. we start with rents receivable and deduct expenses payable to arrive at the overseas property business profit or loss. However, an overseas property business loss, i.e. a loss on a villa in Spain, cannot be set off against UK property profits. This also applies the other way round, so there is never any mixing of UK and overseas profits and losses. So if a taxpayer has an overseas property business loss, that loss can only be carried forward and set against future overseas property business profits. The only exception to the rule, which doesn't permit the mixing of UK and overseas property business profits and losses, is if the UK property business losses are losses on a furnished holiday letting. Remember that losses on FHLs can be set against any income in the same or the previous tax year, and any income will include income from an overseas property business. On a sort of related topic, let's have a quick word about non-resident landlords. Here we have a tenant living in the UK, and he rents a property from a landlord who lives in the United States, i.e. the UK tenant is paying rent to a non-resident landlord. Even though the landlord doesn't live in the UK, he will still be taxable in the UK on his UK source income, i.e. his UK rental income is still taxable in the UK. HMRC has, throughout the years, had difficulty in persuading someone who lives on the other side of the world to pay his tax bill. So what they ask the tenant to do is to withhold basic rate tax, currently 20%, from the rents paid to the foreign landlord. If the letting is through an agent, the agent will do this on the tenant's behalf. So, for example, if the tenant is due to pay rents of £1,000 to the non-resident landlord, what the tenant should actually do is send the landlord a cheque for £800 and send HMRC a cheque for the remaining £200. This is HMRC's way of at least getting some tax in the event that the non-resident landlord decides to ignore his UK tax obligations. If the non-resident landlord is unhappy with this arrangement, he or she can make an application to HMRC to receive his property income gross from the tenant. HMRC will only agree to this application if the non-resident landlord promises to file a self-assessment return and pay his income tax in the normal way. Before agreeing the application, HMRC will look at the landlord's record for filing returns and paying income tax. If the landlord has a good record and is up to date, etc., HMRC will agree to him receiving rents gross. Otherwise, the tax office will reject the application and seek 20% tax at source from the tenant. If no application is made, it is the tenant or agent's responsibility to withhold tax from the rents before they are remitted to the non-resident landlord. To do so, the tenant must inform HMRC residency. Tax should be withheld at the basic rate and sent to the revenue 30 days after each calendar quarter. Calendar quarters run to 30th of June, 30th of September, 31st of December, and 31st of March. The tenant should continue to withhold tax until notified otherwise by the Centre for Non-Residents. Basic rate tax is applied to gross rents, less any tax-deductible expenses paid by the tenant out of the rental income. Each year, the tenant or agent will complete a return and submit it to the revenue. The return is due by the 5th of July after the tax year and certifies the rents paid and the tax withheld. The tenant or agent will also produce a certificate for the landlord showing the tax withheld from the rents. The landlord will use this certificate to complete his self-assessment return. The tax paid will be credited against any tax owing to leave additional tax due or repayable. Companies which invest in property may elect for special rules to apply to their property business and to the profits they distribute to their shareholders. Those companies who make an election are known as UK REITs, Real Estate Investment Trusts. For UK REITs, their qualifying rental income and gains on disposals of investment properties will be exempt from corporation tax. Any profits and gains on any other activities carried on by the UK REIT will be subject to corporation tax in the normal way. Dividends paid out by a UK REIT out of tax-exempt property income or gains will be treated as UK property income in the hands of its shareholders, as opposed to normal dividend income. Investors will be deemed to have received a UK REIT dividend under deduction of basic rate income tax at 20%. UK REIT dividends will therefore be taxed as non-savings income, carrying a 20% tax credit. Unlike normal company dividends, this credit is repayable to non-taxpayers. Dividends paid out of other profits will be treated as normal dividends for UK tax purposes. A company can fall within the UK REIT regime if it is UK resident for tax purposes, its shares are listed on a recognised stock exchange, it distributes at least 90% of its tax-exempt profits each year, 75% or more of its assets must be investment property, 75% or more of its income must be rental income, and no single investor is entitled to 10% or more of the shares. The last area to look at is premiums on leases. Before we do so, we need to define some terms, starting with the word lease. A lease is simply a right to occupy a property for a specified period of time, and usually for a specified rent. Perhaps you are currently occupying property under the terms of some sort of lease. A premium is the amount paid by a tenant to a landlord for the grant of a lease. The person who grants the lease is called the lessor, and the person to whom the lease is granted is called the lessee. So, any premium will be paid by the lessee to the lessor. Here we have a landlord who owns the freehold of a property. By freehold, we mean that the individual owns the land and the building outright. He is not leasing it from someone else. This landlord is granting a lease to the tenant. So what he is doing is giving the tenant a right to occupy his property for a certain period of time. In return, the tenant pays the landlord a premium for the grant of this lease. The tenant now has a piece of paper, giving him the right to occupy the landlord's property for an agreed period of time. Note that the landlord still owns the freehold of the house, so when the lease comes to an end, the landlord can legally take the property back. We are interested in how this premium is taxed in the hands of the landlord as property income. Much of this will depend on the length of the lease. Let's assume a landlord grants a lease and receives a premium in return. If the lease is granted for a period of 50 years or more, i.e. the tenant has a right to occupy the property for at least the next 50 years, none of this premium will be chargeable to income tax as property income. There is no income tax charged here. Instead, the full amount of the premium will be charged to capital gains tax, and we shall leave this for another day. We shall contrast this with the grant of a lease by a landlord to a tenant for a period of less than 50 years, i.e. the tenant has the right to occupy the property for a period of somewhere between 0 and 49 years. Leases of less than 50 years are called short leases, and on the grant of a short lease, only part of the premium received by the landlord is chargeable to income tax as property income. The part of the premium which is not charged to income tax will instead be charged to capital gains tax. To calculate the income tax charge, we take the premium, here we call it P, and we deduct the amount which will be charged to capital gains tax. The amount charged to CGT is 2% of the premium multiplied by N minus 1, where N is the number of years of the lease. The CGT bit we have called C. The difference is the amount chargeable to income tax as property income in the year in which the premium is received by the landlord.
An alternative method for calculating the amount of the premium chargeable as property income is to take the amount of the premium and multiply it by 50 less the length of the lease minus 1 year, then divide the resulting figure by 50. This formula is contained in the legislation at section 288, ITOIA 2008.
One final point here. If the lease provides for some rents to be paid by the tenant to the landlord for the duration of the lease, these rents are charged on the landlord in the normal way, i.e. using the accruals or receivable basis.
By way of an example, let's take a taxpayer called Beth, who owns a property, and on the 5th of October 2010, she grants a 20-year lease on that property to a tenant called Donald.
In return, Donald pays Beth a premium. The premium paid by Donald is £30,000. We need to work out how much of this is chargeable to income tax in the hands of Beth. As Beth has received a premium for granting a lease of less than 50 years, i.e. a short lease, we need to deduct from the £30,000 the amount which is chargeable to capital gains tax. This is 2% of the premium of £30,000 multiplied by 20 minus 1, i.e. by the number of years of the lease minus the first one. This gives us an amount chargeable to CGT of £11,400. The remaining £18,600 is chargeable to income tax as property income. All of this £18,600 is taxed in the year of receipt as non-savings income. The fact that it is received halfway through the year makes no difference. Normally, as part of the rental agreement, Donald will also be required to pay an annual rent for the use of the property. If he does, the rents receivable by Beth will need to be added on to the taxable premium to give the total property income figure for the year.